On today's episode of Nothing Major, we are going to continue to talk all things U.S. Open. We're going to get into ticket credential requests, transport, hotels, and the playing schedule. We're going to assess if any one of the four of us actually had a real chance at winning the U.S. Open. And of course, we are going to answer some of our listener questions about the Open. Welcome back, everyone, to Nothing Major. I am Steve Johnson, joined as always by my co-hosts Sam Querrey, Jack Sock, and John Isner. The three of us, John, Sam, and myself, have all been on the grounds this week in New York, with the exception of Jack, who is on the West Coast at the moment playing pickleball, or as he likes to refer to it as Wiffle. How's your week been, boys?
Last night before I flew here, there was a rattlesnake in our backyard. The dog's like, you know, barking at it, it's hissing. We had the kids in the backyard. We called the fire department. By the time the fire department came, they couldn't find the snake.
Oh, gosh.
And so then just in your mind, you're like, we can never go in the backyard again. We've got a killer just lurking the backyard. But then my wife found online like a snake charmer guy that comes and like finds snakes. He's like, you didn't agitate it. Or like, of course, we sprayed it with water. We're like throwing rocks up there. And he's like, definitely don't do that. Don't do that. But like, he's there right now.
Kill it, or is he going to go release it?
No, he really likes the snakes. He's going to go release it so he can come back.
That's good business for him, though.
And how much does he cost?
I don't know.
Do you know?
I'll pay whatever. I have peace of mind to go in the backyard. We had two in our backyard, one in the street in the last like 3 months.
I think you got to move.
Are you sure they're not all the same? They're just coming back?
No, one was dead.
You pissed them off enough, now the family's coming for you.
Yeah, maybe.
Ugh. I don't. Snakes are my least. I just can't. Mm-mm.
I can handle snakes.
John, you've been in New York now for a few days doing some on-site stuff. How's your week looking?
As you well know, it's a little different being here in a non-playing capacity. First ever time I've experienced that. So getting used to it, a little bit different being at the courts and not having all my tennis gear with me.
No money on the badge for the final eight here, John. We found that out a couple days ago.
Really?
Yeah, we had to ask. Like,
wait, did you guys think there was money on it and you got denied?
No. I didn't try. To get denied would have been so embarrassing.
And then you didn't have your wallet. Had to ask like the guy behind you in line for spot you.
Well, I always have my wallet. For me personally, I went there. I was having some lunch and I kind of looked around and I busted out the wallet and I did a quick swipe of the credit card. and one of the ATP trainers was behind me, John. He's like, what? There's no juice on your badge? I'm like, no, there's not, John. Thank you very much.
Not in a spectator badge.
For all the years that we played there and put in time on those courts, it like
there should be. And sorry to interrupt you, but truthfully, like if we were to bug Buterak, he would fix that. But like, I don't want to bug him.
Yeah, I know.
It's all good.
I've already bugged for like an extra credential. I'm not going to go something like that after the tournament started.
I feel that.
Jack, how's Wiffle life on the West Coast?
Wiffle life's good over here. Was in Salt Lake City, Utah last weekend, which is was my first time actually in Salt Lake.
The home of pickleball.
Yeah, Utah's crazy for pickleball. Yeah, it was we played in a convention center on a cement floor. They did this Acrotech courts on. My hip is not feeling the best after playing on cement.
Hey Jack, question. What's a worse feeling? Losing first and first in pickleball? Because I noticed that happened to you, or losing like first round or first round of tennis.
I must say my singles motivation for pickleball is getting less and less and less. Mixed doubles loss was not the best. Probably first and first in pickle, just because like you're leaving home, like you're leaving your family to go like lose a 32-minute pickle match.
Yeah,
six timeouts are called.
Jack, can you please lob that same question back to Sam, because he has a lot of experience there?
No.
What do you mean no?
No, Sam's a consistent second round.
I don't think I've lost first round mixed and first round men's doubles in a pickleball tournament.
I don't agree with that statement, Sam. There's no way that can be correct.
I probably have. I would have to go back and look at the past results.
Do you know what a bye feels like? So I was technically second round in both.
That's a good point.
All right, let's get into a tennis topic.
Okay, so one thing I think we all can agree on, especially at Grand Slams and even more so at the U.S. Open, tickets slash credentials, for your friends, for your family. It's kind of annoying. It's just one of those things that, I mean, for me, I would just enlist my agent to do it all. But you're getting text messages the day before your match, sometimes the morning of your match, asking for tickets, asking for to be in your player box if you're playing on a big court. And Arthur Ashe's like 16 seats or something like that.
The amount of people that would come out of the woodworks that you haven't talked to in who knows how long that are all of a sudden, I'm going to be in New York at that time, or I live in New York now. I remember, you know, when we had English class together freshman year of high school, and I was like, and then now they're like, oh, can I bring me and my girlfriend or me and my boyfriend, you know, whoever, to, you know, come watch the Open. And I felt like it was something you almost had to like maybe nip in the bud early on in your career, like not be so generous with tickets, because then I feel like it just got out of control. And to your point, it was something you just left to your agent, or a, you know, family member if they wanted to be in charge of them. But yeah, over the years of playing the Open, I feel like the amount of people that I wouldn't even consider a friend or I'm close to at all that would reach out, it was almost something that you knew every year coming into New York that it was probably going to happen. But yeah, it would be frustrating at times, without a doubt.
Did you guys ever have those people, like if you would be out of the tournament, and they would hit you up for like, oh, hey, can you help me get a, like, oh, you know, yes, quarterfinal night matches for Roger, as if like you could get tickets to Ash on a Friday night for like a big semifinal. It's like,
great point.
And you never want to be mean with the text back. Like, oh, yeah, I'll look into it. Like, let me see what I can do. Yeah. And you never did.
Yeah.
I feel like Jack, better than the three of us, like, I feel like Jack could kind of just go no reply on people a lot easier. And am I right there, Jack? I feel like you have a lot of unread messages, yeah, on your phone.
Jack's definitely going unreply for sure.
Wait, what?
How many unread text messages, you know, or your messages you have not responded to on your phone? But
The red number on my phone says 620.
Exactly.
Oh, there's my gosh. Point.
So you, and it's not a bad quality.
I wonder if any of those are from like the 2015 US Open trying to like hit you up for tickets.
They probably are. Yeah, that's not like,
and I'm not ripping you. It's not a bad quality. It's almost a good quality.
Feels like you are.
Not at all. I'm prefacing it by saying like it's not a bad quality. It's you could kind of just maybe ignore a request like that, where like maybe Sam, Stevie, and I would be like, oh, dude, like I don't know, or I'll see what I can do. And then you drag it on and inevitably you don't get that person to court.
Yeah, I guess that was the king of post-tournament. So sorry for the delay on this. I'm just now seeing it.
Yeah.
Sorry, I couldn't help.
Yeah, that's a good thing. I think that's a good thing.
That is a good thing for sure.
Exactly.
For times like that, yes. But then other times it also, you know, maybe an important message gets lost in there. And then
There's two types of people. Some that have 620 text messages or iMessages, and some, like for me, I have three right now looking.
You probably have zero email red numbers too, probably.
I have four, yep, emails because I need to respond to them.
I have 36,000.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
I mean, that just gives me anxiety just thinking about it,
right? Wouldn't be able to sleep at night seeing that.
Stevie, I know you have it, but you probably have zero, Stevie.
I have zero red numbers on my phone at all times. I can't live with those numbers, like any notifications.
Yeah, I know.
I need to start over.
Well, yeah, just delete everything and start over.
I'm just going to start over.
I feel like, though, if you gave your number or the person who's asking for tickets to your agent, ultimately everyone got a ticket anyway. I always feel like no one ever like got left out.
Correct.
The staff and the people working in the offices there, I feel like as an American player at that tournament, they always went above and beyond to try to help, which was,
yes,
which was amazing.
Would you guys ever go in and ask, like, I just need two more credentials and only for 2 days, as if that was like better? I would sometimes throw that in.
Yeah, I would.
Or like, this person's not coming for 2 days, so he's not coming back till Friday. Yeah, yeah, so why don't you take him off and put him?
Yes.
I wouldn't do that because I would just be so ashamed to do it. I just couldn't. I did it a few times. Changing subject just a little bit. Did y'all ever have like a horrible transportation experience at the US Open? Like, I remember one time like getting in a car at the same hotel, a different car at the same hotel as someone else, and arriving to the site 45 minutes after that person.
Oh, yes, dude. 100%.
Because there's a bunch of different ways to get to the city.
Yeah.
And like, that's the worst. Like, you can, all right, my practice is in 3 hours at noon. I'm going to leave at 9. I'm going to give myself an hour, plenty of time, blah, blah, blah. And the next thing you know, it takes an hour and 45 minutes to get to the site on like a Wednesday. You're like, what is going on? It's the worst.
It's a different route every time.
Yeah, just hope that your driver took the right one. And I don't know, I usually always trust them. They're usually a lot of like ex-cops, and like they've been in the city for so
long.
Love
the drivers.
And they know,
the ex-cop drivers are the best.
Yeah, they're incredible. And they somehow get there. But yeah, you've had some like sweating bullets in the car because practice. I mean, yeah, you leave well ahead of time from the city and you have no time. You're basically running in, going to the locker room, having to text the people that you're practicing with. Oh, you might have to start 5 minutes late because you obviously want to get warmed up, not get injured. But definitely had some stressful drives out to the site.
No, it'd be cool if they had, you know, the 7 train that like goes from downtown right to the venue. It'd be cool if they had. If on the subway they could reserve like one of the cars for like credentials or players only or the staff, and you could take that out to the courts. I would actually do that, I think, if you knew you were going to get on a subway where like one of the train cars was reserved only for U.S. Open credential people.
Like a chartered train?
Chartered train.
That's actually a really good idea, Sam.
Such a good idea. I'm going to run that by Eric Buderak later today. This is genius.
How long does it take to get out there on that?
Not like 30, 35 minutes.
It's like 22 minutes. It would be an express train, too.
Okay.
It would be express, right from Grand Central, right out there. I'm making up all the rules as I go.
They should just do that every year for, yeah, players and credentials.
I have a question for you. You ever have a celebrity hit you up for tickets at the U.S. Open?
I mean, I'm not a celebrity guy. I don't know if you guys can
drop that name. Who is it?
No, I just had like other like sports people, like, you know, from other sports that come out and they're like their off season or whatever that wanted to come out. And
like Michael Jordan?
No, it'd be either like baseball or hockey or something. Like that. But no, no celebrities for me. That would definitely be more of a John question, I feel like. It's the mayor of Highland Park, as Jack has, you know, duly stated.
I think if this wasn't something I set up beforehand, but someone we all know, big celebrity in my mind, he just happens to love tennis and he splits his time between New York and California, is Ben Stiller. He's watched me play a few times in the U.S. Open. That wasn't me setting that up. That's just him coming as a fan to New York. So he's probably the biggest celeb that's ever watched my match. Actually, legitimately my favorite actor of all time as well. So that's having pretty cool watching, you know, having Ben Stiller watch you play tennis. He's like the most down to earth dude.
Nicest dude.
He's unbelievable. Yeah.
I had one that happened to be at my match and turned into like a mini friendship but it was not like planned. I didn't know him or it was planned ahead of the match. Happened to be there and then ended up messaging each other after the match.
Yeah, no. can you reveal who this person is?
It wasn't a ticket request or anything, so I mean.
Well, who was it?
Can't leave us hanging now.
It was a cool U.S. Open experience. I was playing fourth round against Tsonga in 2016?
On Armstrong,
yeah.
Yeah, I remember that.
In-form Tsonga, who was very good. I was sitting there on a changeover and looking straight across in the front row was OBJ.
All right, everyone, a little context here for our listeners outside of North America. OBJ stands for Odell Beckham Jr., the American football star.
And I was a bit, like, shocked why he was, I guess, at my match of all matches that was going on.
He was there to watch Joe.
Most likely. I came to find out. Come to find out his, like, one of the trainers for the Giants, one of the gym, you know, workout trainers, actually followed American tennis and took him to that match and ended up playing. And then he tweeted something about the match I saw afterwards. And then we ended up messaging and exchanging numbers. And then he invited me out to the Kanye concert the next night, even though I lost. That's when I stayed in the city one extra day. And I went to the garden with him and like his crew, and my brother was with me. And like enjoyed a Kanye concert with like the OBJ treatment in the city. It was kind of wild.
Yeah, and like 2016, like that would have been like right after he made that catch. He was like, that was like, yeah, the height of his powers.
This was prime. This is like the French fry hair. He was like prime OBJ. Yeah. The blonde curlies. Yeah, it was.
Haven't you hung out with Travis Kelce before too? Kansas City guys.
Yes, dude. Stevie, back up. This is Jack. Like, he's boys with like Mahomes, Kelce,
I mean,
OBJ. That's a good thing, dude. Like,
that's great.
Like, Mahomes came out and watched Indian Wells. Travis came out to watch Indian Wells when they were out there, but not. That was kind of my, I guess, my top open story.
If you text Travis Kelce right now, over under on days it takes for him to get back to you.
Pre T Swift, it would be within 24 hours. Post T Swift, probably leaves me on red.
One of the 620 messages that you
yeah,
got.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Reversal. I'm that guy.
Competing podcast guy.
Yeah, they're doing pretty well.
Yeah. Watch out.
We're coming.
Sam, any good stories for you or?
Not at the Open. I've never had like a celebrity at the Open, but one time at the Queens tournament before Wimbledon, I was playing Jordan Thompson and CB, Craig Boynton, who coaches all, was in my player box. And I remember I was on the far side of the court and some random person went and sat next to CB in the player box. And I remember kind of looking at CB and giving him a look like, who's sitting there? Like, ask this random person to leave. And CB looking at me like, I can't do it. Like, I'm like, I just lost the set. And I think we split sets.
Oh,
and
then yeah, you were a little annoyed.
I was a little annoyed. And so then we switched sides. I was about to go over there and say something. And as I get closer, I realize it's David Beckham.
What?
He had just like stumped out of the Queens tournament, and sat next to CB. And I was like, I totally get it. You can't say anything to him. He can stay there. And I immediately like focused back in and won the match. But
yes,
I still remember Craig's look like, I'm not going to say anything to this person. He's going to sit wherever he wants.
No way. That's sick.
Yeah, you can't kick him out of the box. No, that would be, I mean, that would be like a career suicide. Yeah.
He wasn't coming out to watch me necessarily. I think he showed up and they walked out to the courts. And I just happened to have one person in my player box and they saw a row of 8 seats. Like, Mr. Beckham, just please sit right here.
So obviously you didn't know. I feel like I would have known that was Beckham. Like,
it was across the court, like in Queens. Right. You know, I was on the far side, oh, okay. And I yeah, it
yeah,
was
yeah 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 yeah.
Do you have like a hat and sunnies on?
Exactly. You had like the hat, the sunglasses, the trendy outfit. You can't really tell. I thought it was like some artist. It's like, well, get out of my box.
Only the three, you know, outside of the four of us, Sam would be the only person to actually like go over there and say something to him, right? Like, none of us would say anything.
Yeah, I didn't say anything.
No, I would say something to CB.
I don't know. Like, Sam has, like, a lot of, like, awkward interactions, you know, from time to time.
But he's Larry David.
He is Larry David.
He's Larry David.
It'd be tough to tell David Beckham to just get up and go somewhere else.
That would be ballsy.
That would be real ballsy.
Especially there in London. That would be very ballsy.
If you couldn't tell it was him from like across the court and you're that agitated after losing the first set, I could have like, yeah, you could have yelled something from across or like,
no, get out.
You out of here, buddy.
Did you guys have a big say or big feelings about how or who sat in your box kind of thing? Like, was there people that annoyed you? Sammy, were you pretty particular with that other than kicking David Beckham out of your box?
Nah, I mean, if I was like feeling good and confident, I might talk with like my agent or my wife and kind of say, these are the 7 people I care about. You guys do whatever you want with the other 8 seats. And then I just went about the match. I wasn't overly particular. Some people, Isner was like real particular.
Yeah, I think I was. I would give some direction. This person, yes, yes, yes. This person, no, no, no.
Yeah.
And like, absolutely no. Like, figure it out. I don't care. I don't want to deal with it.
Would you give him direction on where specific people could sit in the given player box?
No, no, I wasn't that ridiculous. I always thought the whole sitting in the box thing is just so, so ridiculous. Like, I really respect how Daniil Medvedev goes about it. Remember he's playing the US Open final and, like, Djokovic's, or I forget whoever he was playing, it's like every seat was full and there's 23,000 people there and they pan to Daniil's box and it's his coach and wife. And there's 14 empty seats around him. Like, he does it right. And so I just always thought that everything was so ridiculous.
All right, guys, let's talk about US Open court times. Some people like to play day matches. Some people like to play night matches. Some players have their agents that will go in and kind of, you know, go into the ATP offices and try to vouch for their player to get a specific time. I didn't really care too much, but I guess I would rather play in like the evening if I had my choice.
I'm going to have to agree with that and then some. I have a feeling a couple of the other guys in here are going to be very, very different than me. But I, for one, just with the chaos of the city, there's a couple of things. The chaos of the city and, like, I didn't like rushing around. I liked waiting, honestly, to play. I liked having my time to just get ready and kind of more relax. So I always prefer, and I think that the tournament obviously had a feel for this throughout my career, but I preferred fourth on, and large in part because of my sweating problems and almost PTSD I had at that tournament from cramping out a couple times during the day. I just wanted to play later in the day. Hopefully it was a little cooler. I loved the crowd and electricity as it got wilder and wilder, I feel like, throughout the day. And then night, fans consuming beverages and just having fun and being loud. So I know my other co-hosts here are going to strongly disagree with me, but what y'all think?
John and I, for sure, 11 a.m., no questions asked. First on, get in, get out.
I didn't want to wake up at 5 a.m. and go to this courts at like 7 a.m. And like, I just...
There's no better feeling, as John, you know, as knows, it's like you win at 11, you're done.
Yeah.
You go in there, you get lunch, you get your treatment, you're back in the city by like 4:30, 5, and like, you're done. Like, there's still matches. Like, Jack hasn't even started for like another 3 hours and you are done for the day. The rest of the day was yours, but that's just kind of how I was.
People don't talk about the morning matches, though. People talk about the night matches, Sock versus Bublik, or like the night session on Ash.
I get it. No, I...
Yeah, but if you win, like...
Doesn't matter.
Who cares? Like, you're on to the next round, and you're going to go enjoy a dinner. And I'm with Stevie. I like to play... I mean, if it wasn't 11, like, I'd like to be second on. I just...
It also helped your game a lot with your serve and everything.
It did help my game a lot. I was a much better player during the day than I was at night. I completely lacked the ability to hit overheads at night out of the air. I just can't track the ball. It's one thing I can't.
Wait, really?
Do you not remember in Houston what happened to Isner when he's playing Ryan Sweeting?
Yeah, no, I know.
Like 12 years ago?
No.
I'll tell it real quick, but like John was playing Ryan Sweeting maybe 12 years ago in Houston. I believe this happened in a tiebreaker.
Match point.
Your match point?
John's match point. In Houston, the lights are tough. He hits like a good approach. Sweeting goes over, hits an absolute like sky lob. John's backing up, loses it. John's near like the baseline, kind of near the doubles alley, and the ball just hits him in the back.
No, it didn't.
In the air. Yes, hits him in the back during the air and loses the point.
I was standing in the double, like the ball was going out, like the ball was out. And I'm just like,
oh my goodness. Did you win the match?
I think that made it 6-4. Then I hit an ace.
Okay.
Anyway, so you know,
that's like an unbelievable way to lose a point, though. That's unreal.
He was standing in the alley, and the ball hit him in the air.
I don't think tennis TV existed back then. I'd like to find that. Yeah, but like just lights in general, I just struggle like picking up the ball.
Even at the Open, like a night match, like those lights are perfect.
I know, but just something about taking it out of the air. I was really good at a bounce. I think I have the best bounce overhead of all time.
Always to the backhand corner.
Yes, always to the backhand corner, the one side. I also can't hit an overhead cross court. You're right. I can only hit it inside out.
I never hit one.
I lack the ability to hit it. I would shank it every single time.
You always pronated that way.
Always pronate that way. That's a good point, Jack. And I just prefer the day. I like the sun being out. I like the ball flying through the air quick. And I like sort of knowing my fate early. I prefer to play on Monday, if possible. Like, give me Monday, 11 a.m., and I'm a happy camper.
Tuesday, fourth on.
Yeah, John's been in the second round for like 36 hours, you know?
Exactly.
You don't want to play like second night match, but I'm with Jack. Like, that match at dusk is perfect when you're playing in New York.
Oh, yeah.
No, that's good. It's such a good time.
Like, vibe around the courts.
The second night match, I had a second night match once at the U.S. Open on Ash. And lo and behold, I lost to Philip Kohlschreiber again. but your second night match, it was, you know, I think Sharapova was before me. And she gets on, and there's a rain delay. So, like, I didn't get on the court till like 10:30, 11. And the atmosphere wasn't even, like, that great. It was like
it's good for, like, the first set.
Yeah. Exactly. And then I ended up, it was so hot because the rain came and it made it so hot and humid. And I lost at like 2:35 in the morning. Like,
I'm not necessarily that. I'm more like, fourth on of one of the other ones that you're going to get on at like that dust time.
Yeah, getting it, playing a match at 5 o'clock at the US Open is pretty
it's
nice. Cool.
It's really nice.
Yeah.
It's a good point.
I played second night match there 2017 against Kevin Anderson. Not as late as the 2:30 Isner match that you played the one year. And it wasn't like really packed. You know how that kind of gets, John, when you start too late, like Ash isn't super packed.
Yeah, totally.
And there was this guy in like the lower bowl, maybe 10 rows up. I don't know if it was Kevin's friend or something. Most obnoxious guy I've ever met. He had a comment like every point we get quiet, he would like say something. And I wanted to hit this guy in the face the entire match. I lose the match. And then afterwards, I'm near transportation, and he comes up to me. He, like, sees me and says kind of a sarcastic, like, hey, good match today. I didn't say anything, and I think about it still to this day. Like, I wish I would have hit him in the face. I wish I would have hit him in the face. If I see him in the city, I'm punching him.
What was he yelling out between points?
Just, I can't remember, like, specific, like, things he would yell out, but just very much, like, against me, for Kevin, would wait till it was quiet, be like, you know, Sam, Kevin's got this one. Like, you know, you can't beat him, stuff like that. He was just so obnoxious.
I have a question here. Did y'all prefer Armstrong or Ash? I much preferred Armstrong over Ash. Like, I even when I was number one American.
Old or new, or didn't matter?
I loved the old Armstrong. The new Armstrong was incredible. I loved the old Armstrong. The walk from the locker room to the Armstrong, you'd walk through all the food. And you'd pick up all the smells of the food.
I started cramping before I got out there.
Yes, dude. You see, just like straight hot dogs and hamburgers, like wafting right into your nostrils. Like,
it was so hot.
So hot.
What do you mean? I was like, I got fired up going out there.
It was a good thing, but it would always like, it would make me really nervy. Like, all right, I'm about to walk out and play this match. Here come the hamburgers. Here come the hot dogs. Here comes the beers. You can just smell it all.
Two bags on your shoulders. My shoulders are fatigued by the time I get out there. I was like, this is just.
It's a long walk, dude.
But on the way back, conversely, you could just grab one of those beers and those hamburgers if you had lost, you know? It's a win-win.
That's probably what you did, Stevie.
Once.
If you won like a big third round match on Armstrong, that walk like from Armstrong back to the locker room is maybe the best feeling in the world.
The best.
Into the fourth round, you have a day off the next day. Like, life is good. You're going to walk around the players' lounge. Everyone's going to tell you good job.
The best. Yeah.
That honestly might be one of the biggest things to miss is a day off after a win at the Open.
Yeah. You sleep great the night before. There's no stress.
Easy practice for 30 minutes.
That's actually, I miss those days off at a slam.
You guys ever have a year where you went into the Open legitimately feeling like you could win it?
No.
Or at some point during the tournament, you maybe thought, like, I think I could win it?
Yeah, if, like, food poisoning came through the locker room, maybe, you know? I mean...
If like the top 20 guys in the world, like transportation showed up late and they got defaulted.
If Sam's scallops at the Open, like got everyone bad, you know?
I think all of us felt nerves early on in a tournament. Like, especially if you're, you know, you're maybe favored to win. Like, you know, but once you get to the business end of the tournament, I think, you know, you're more confident. Yeah. Your body's feeling good. Like, yeah, for sure.
I think a good run. I don't know winning the tournament, but I felt like a good run. Like that 2016 year I played. Like I played Chilich third round, who was a high seed, and I was just like I kind of like fairly routine and just in straight sets. Like I felt like I could make the second week and you know maybe make a cool run. But
did he have a bad day with his forehand? Like Chilich could go off on the forehand.
Oh my gosh, yeah, he could. Yeah, he was. And it wasn't like a non-high first serve percentage day because I feel like he had won a sneaky best serve. Like if he was serving well,
totally.
It was good.
He also owned Americans for the better part of 15 years.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, I mean, and I think I was in his head because I just came off of that Portland comeback win against him in Davis Cup.
Ah, yeah.
That like a month prior or whatever. And I think he was. I don't know. It was still. But anyways, yeah, I think. Yeah, a couple of good runs. Even that one of those last years, even that Zverev match for like a set and a half, I'd already won my first round. And then I've been honestly playing some of the best tennis of my life. And unfortunately, my adductor went, but felt like I could do something there. But not winning the tournament, probably not, to be honest.
I mean, but, you know, with Sam and John, I mean, you guys are obviously the two guys that made it the farthest in Grand Slams, having looks at it. You know, I know John, you know, you believe that you could win the Open. I know it was a tall ask with the big three and those other guys. But what were your thoughts going into it those years that where you were top 10, you know, going in there to be, to go out there and contend for a U.S. Open title?
It was sort of nice. And it was nice to have that pressure on you. It means you've done a lot of good stuff in the year prior leading up to that U.S. Open. And, you know, that's just like when you're top 10 in the world, like Jack, you know, like you're naturally confident and you kind of go into a tournament with a little bit of a swagger and then you get to the business end of the event. And for me, it was, I think it was the 2018 US Open. Like I lost like a tight four sets to Delpo in the quarters. And then like Roth ended up like pulling out against him, like in the semis, like I could have beaten him in the quarterfinals and like no one would ever pull out against me because they'd have to have like literally a broken leg. But because they could get to a tiebreaker against me with a broken leg. But, like, you know, that you kind of realize, like, you know, it was more likely than not. Of course, I wasn't going to win it, but I did believe that I could win the tournament, especially that year in 2018.
I felt like that in 2017. I lost to Kevin Anderson in the quarters, but going into that match, the winner was playing Pablo Carreño Busta in the semis.
Oh, that's right.
And then Rafa in the finals, and I had beaten Rafa earlier in the year, so that was like the one year I actually felt going into the quarters like I could win this tournament if, you know, things set up right.
You were playing like, yeah, because like I lost to Zverev, Misha, and then in the third round, and then you beat him in the round of 16 or something, right? Like, was it that year?
Yeah, that was the best match I've ever played.
Yeah, like I was like. Wasn't thinking ahead. I'm like, oh, I could, you know, potentially play Sam in the round of 16 to open, and like I lose to Misha, and then like you beat him like a drunk.
6-2, 6-1, 6-2. Literally the greatest match I've ever played.
Yeah.
Was he serving volley?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was just seeing the ball like a watermelon. I think I was so excited that I like maybe like didn't have to play Isner, you know, because it's like it would have, it's like a weird tension.
Totally.
Like, you got to play your buddy in this like big, we all played each other, but no one really played each other in a big grand slam match, I don't think.
Yeah, I played Stevie in the first round of his slam, but like, and you in the first round of a slam, but not like, you know, like a round of 16.
Fourth round, yeah, or anything like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Like it would have been a different feeling, I guess.
John's in my first round match might have been the coolest match I may have ever played, but I think it ultimately ends up being one of the most depressing matches I've ever played. Like as a kid, I grow up, you know, watching Americans play each other, night match, US Open, crowd full, you know,
oh, yeah,
stadium buzzing. This, it's like absolute chaos and pandemonium, and you absolutely like want to live for that. So we play each other during the COVID year, and we play on Armstrong, night match. There is four people in there. It's it's Clint Cordial, it's David McPherson, it's Craig Boynton, and Paul Kinney. Like our four people in separate sides of the stadium. We played a 7-6 in the fifth match. Like it could have been like the coolest like experience of all time, like playing, you know, an unreal night match. And then we just like, that's it. There's four people. Like you see like the workers, like four or five workers walking around. It was depressing. Like, I mean, like depressing. I don't know how John felt about it.
No, it was very weird. Every tournament that year.
I watched it on TV.
It's a bit depressing having four people there. And you can hear a pin drop the entire time. All right, let's talk a little bit about Arthur Ashe Stadium, the biggest stadium in tennis that we have. Jack, didn't you face Andy Roddick in there one of your first U.S. Opens?
Yeah, that was my first surreal, can't believe this is happening moment, I guess, in tennis. 2011 was my second U.S. Open. I had a wild card from Kalamazoo that year. Happy to win my first round, which was awesome. Go on to play Andy Roddick, second round, who was my idol growing up. I'm going to have, safe to say, I think we're the only two tennis players to ever come out of the state of Nebraska to be successful. Both huge Husker fans. So for me, it was a crazy, surreal moment. Schedule comes out. It's second night match or either one night match on Arthur Ashe on Friday night of the first week. I'm told it's on ESPN or ESPN2. It was my first time ever on TV. I just graduated high school a few months prior. I'm 18 years old and yeah, it was just crazy. And being in the locker room, obviously Andy's kind of, even if you're friendly with him, he's maybe not, you know, he doesn't really talk to you that much before. He kind of likes to be a little intimidating, I would say, you know, before you go out there or kind of, you know, not say a whole lot. And I think he it was one of his last, you know, U.S. Open. So he'd been around the block forever. And I was a new guy coming on. And I honestly wasn't all that nervous going out because I probably didn't really think I had a chance to win. And I was excited for the moment. And I went on to get broken once a set or in one, maybe twice a set like normal and got beating straight sets and it was really fun. I feel like it was a moment I'll always look back on just as crazy, surreal start to my career at that moment. It was wild.
Yeah, Jack, I can pick up that. I know what you're talking about with Andy, especially when, I mean, really throughout his whole career, but when he was the top dog in American tennis, which he was for so long. I mean, he was like, you know, top five in the world for years and years and years. When you went up against him, there was this intimidating nature about him. He maybe wouldn't talk to you that much. He would just maybe give you maybe a quick, like, terse little, hey, what's up, you know. But the day of the match, like, he's not talking to you. That's just the kind of competitor he was. Like, my first ever ATP final, I played against him in Washington, D.C., and, like, it was, you know, he wanted to win that match, obviously. So he's kind of, without using any gamesmanship whatsoever, because that's not what he did, he was had this intimidating presence about him. And he was like this kind of big, like super strong guy. Like, you know, he's in incredible shape. He's going to go out there. He's going to try to like outlast you, outgrind you, outwill you. And you know that going in. And he's kind of very intense in the locker room before. I mean, not like Rafa intense, but you know he's ready to go, right? And
I was going
to
say, it was kind of like a different version of Rafa, but kind of the same, where you're like, this is going to be a long day or a long match or like.
Yeah. And when you warm up against him in the match, like his first serve, when you go to his first serve is 137 miles an hour. I mean, it's like unbelievable how hard he hits the very first serve in the warm up.
He was the only guy that could wake up out of bed and then instantaneously go hit a serve 132 miles an hour without ever warming up.
It was absurd. And like, for me, it was just like, I had a big serve, like, you know, my 12th one would be big. His first one out of the gate, every Davis Cup practice at 9 a.m., boom. Like, what is wrong? What's wrong with you, dude? Like, you didn't warm up your shoulder like more than I did. We did the same stuff. And he would rip overheads in the warm-up. Same thing. Like, he would just absolutely annihilate the ball on his overheads and his serve. And then he kind of bunt his little backhand around.
He wasn't afraid to, like, pass you when you're at the net taking volleys in the warm-up or, like, hit a ball away from you either, just, like, rope a winner, like, in the warm-up. I was just like, all right, like, am I supposed to run for that? Or I just let that go and then – I don't know. Yeah. It was intimidating for sure. Especially seeing the serve like the first time like that. I don't know. Yeah, it was.
I mean, his serve had like, he was like, obviously, you know, Sampras, these guys had amazing serves, but like Roddick's serve was like the first one. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. That like really like, even you watch on TV, like you could sense the pop of it. And then you see it in person and play against him. Like it was heavy, dude.
Yeah.
I never played him. I just hit with him a bunch, you know, Davis Cup or whatever. But it was like, the ball just felt like it was just heavy. Like you were hitting like a giant grapefruit coming off your racket. And it didn't make sense because, you know, you play guys who have 130 plus mile per hour serve and you're like, oh, that's not too bad for some reason, but it's no different. I don't know what it is or if you guys can shed some light on it, but it was just like heavy.
He had that like kind of like iconic motion, you know, like the same motion. And he just like quick coil and boom, pop it like so fast, so heavy. And he would do it right out of the gate and he would never relent, like ever. Like first serve to last serve of the match is full bore 100% every single time. His serve on Arthur Ashe, like watching on TV, it was like massive.
It's a joke.
It was like, it was an absolute joke how hard he could hit that thing, especially on Ashe.
I feel like for a while he was the only guy too that would hit 140. Like he was like unanimously had the fastest, biggest serve in tennis for like a 5-year period where John, like when we were playing, like there was 25 guys that could hit serves in the high 130s. There was a period where like only Andy could hit it 140.
It did seem like that.
And that's what like really separated him too.
I mean, we could be wrong, but like that's what I remember. Like absolutely, totally.
That's what I remember as well.
All right, guys. So we put out on our socials a question here of what our thoughts here for the major mailbag. Some fan asked questions to the boys here. So let's kick it off. I'm going to go to John first here. And this question is from Sam Mettler. What is the coolest thing about the player experience at the U.S. Open for you?
I think getting like picked up in like the brand new Lexuses, like waiting outside your hotel, like kind of navigating through the New York City traffic into the Midtown Tunnel on the way to the courts. Like, I thought that was a nice perk. I mean, I know the US Open, they make a lot of money, but they treat the players very, very well. So for me, like, I always, the ride can be unnecessarily long sometimes, but just being in that car with your coach and your team, like, I always enjoyed that. It was kind of a good time to maybe unwind a little bit before the craziness began. But like getting in those brand new nice Lexuses, that's a pretty nice player perk in my opinion.
Do you remember, I want to say it was 2015 when the gifting suite started at the US Open the players?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it was sponsored by Nordstrom. You got to go in there, every player, and it was basically like a room, maybe like a hotel size suite on site, and you got to pick 20 items. It'd be like a perfume, sunglasses, a scarf, like a gift card. And you just like filled up this giant gift bag full of like really nice items from Nordstrom's. Yeah. That was probably the coolest.
They would give you a gift card. Was that the tournament where like I sold you my $250 gift card for like $200?
No, that was Australia.
Oh, yeah. Australia did the same thing, and they had a department store called, what was that department store in Australia?
It was like Myers. I think it was called Myers.
I'm going to get called frugal again, but no, I mean,
you're just making money.
I wasn't going to use it, but I gave Sam a good deal on it.
Yeah, you sold him a $250 gift card for like $200.
Yes.
It was a great deal. I gave it to my wife. Like, it's win-win for everyone.
It was a win-win for everybody there, that's for sure.
All right, next question is from Point Monogram. Strange name. Are the hotels comped at the U.S. Open?
No. So the big tournaments, I would say at least the slams, maybe a few others, we get a per diem. The tournament just adds that on because it is such a big tournament, and trying to figure out logistically hotels for, 128 main draw players, qualies players, men's, women's doubles, like that's just logistically, a nightmare. So everybody kind of does their own thing. And for me, I always stayed at, I basically stayed at two hotels in my US Open career for the most part. And that was kind of through my agency with Sam Duvall. I know John stayed there a few times. Sam stayed there a few times. So we would stay there. We would do the odd sponsors visit or like cocktail hour to, get a, our suite or whatever, just to make kind of our lives more comfortable. But from like our coaches and trainer standpoint, I wasn't really that picky at all. Like I wanted my, with Sam, I mean, all of us have used Christian Lacasse on here as our trainer and our therapist. And he would always stay with us because he would, be hands-on with us at all times. And also, we also had Craig Boynton as our coach at some point in our career. And you just knew he was staying at a Marriott. Didn't matter where. He's got 10 billion Marriott points. So it's, you just never worried about him. So he was always doing his own thing. So for me, it was always just like, take care of my room and Christian's room. Sam and I, who split them forever, would kind of make sure that was set up. But, for CB and the coaching, they kind of did their own thing, wherever they needed to be.
I just needed it dark and I needed it cold. And that's all I needed.
John taught us that that air conditioning hack on the machine where you could, sometimes the air conditioning in the rooms can only go to like 65 degrees.
You can override it, yeah.
Like up, down, hold, enter, hold down, and then you can override it down to like 40 degrees.
It'd be snowing in your room.
Yeah, you can get it, you get it onto into VIP mode. Because there's a governor, yes. Right? And it gets you can't go past, and it's not a true 65. It's like,
it's a
so
bluff.
You get it down to bluff 65. You pump it down to 60, and it's like 62, 63 degrees.
I know you taught all of us, but how did you get it before, like, the Instagram craze, like, or TikTok, whatever, like?
It was my brother, Jordan. He was just constantly hot, like, all the time, and he figured it out. I remember him, like, texting me, like, dude, like, it only would work on that certain thermostat. It didn't work on all of them.
It was like that white square thermostat.
Yes.
Look, yeah, exactly. You see the one in my room? It's right there.
That Honeywell over there.
That's the one.
That's the one.
Dude, your room can get so cold tonight.
If you remember the algorithm to override it, text it to me.
I do remember it. Of course I do. You hold down up arrow and the down arrow. You hold them. You hit display. Then you hit the control button or something. I would have to see it. I know how to do it right away. But Sam, see, it's going to pop into VIP VIP mode. And you'll sleep well tonight. Do it tonight, dude.
I will. Did you guys see what the per diem is this year at the US Open?
It's like 600, no?
Yeah. When we played the US Open, you got $300 a night on per diem, which is like one room. It's 600 now.
Jeez.
That's for all qualifiers, too.
They could also just give more prize money.
US Open does pretty well.
US Open, no, I'm great. I'm saying this out of jealousy. Okay, we got one more. This is from Ricky Hoda. Stevie J, you got knocked out of the Open 7 times in the first round. Thoughts?
I first thought comes to my mind is it's really hard to make the US Open, okay? And I think I played it 14 times, so 7 times I made it past the first round. 64 guys lose every year in the first round. I lost to Fritz, Dimitrov.
Fognini, Kyrgios, those are tough.
What am I supposed to do with these? Sheesh. There's a few others that I'm not proud of. But look, the US Open is very hard, and at the end of the day, F you, Ricky. I'm done with you. No more fan questions from you, okay? Just get off my back. Thank you.
That was funny.
All right, Jack, let's close out this episode here. So thanks for tuning in, everyone, to another episode of Nothing Major. If you're enjoying this podcast, be sure to subscribe, leave us a rating and review. We would really appreciate it.
Be sure to follow us on all the socials with the handle @NothingMajorPod to join in the conversation and make sure you don't miss an episode.
Enjoy the US Open. See you guys next week.
See you next week.
That's f-ing perfect. F*** you guys.